Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Inflation has come down. We think it's going to continue to come down. But to get it back to target, which we must do, we're going to have to hold interest rates in what I call a sort of restrictive setting for some extended period.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
That is Andrew Bailey, the governor of the Bank of England, last month talking about how the central bank was keeping interest rates on hold, and they've done that again since. And whilst he's saying they might have to raise them again if inflation bounces back, investors are betting on bond rates based on interest rates coming down sooner rather than later. So why are we so fixated on interest rates? How do they work? And what would happen if we had an interest rate that just didn't move, a fixed interest rate? I mean, it would do get rid of a lot of speculation and uncertainty, which might do a few people out of a job. But would it also mean we'd lose control of inflation? We look at that this week on the Debunking Economics podcast. So interest rates, I think they're inevitable, aren't they? Even without banks. So if I lend money to someone, I want it back with a bit extra to compensate for two things. First of all, the risk I need to factor in for the loan, you know, going bad and not getting paid back. And secondly, I guess there's the lost opportunity of using the money for something else. And presumably, the more people want to borrow with a limited number of borrowers, then the higher those interest rates are going to be. If I know that I'm the only one lending money, then I'm going to charge more for it. I mean, Steve, that is fundamentally how interest rates work and why they exist, isn't it? Even if we didn't have banks, that is just the natural order of things, isn't it?
Pretty much. I mean, and I've been through a personal experience that I never want to repeat. But if you lend money to someone, then you can't spend it yourself. And we're talking in terms of individuals who can't create money. So if I lend money from myself to Fred Nurk, and Fred Nurk tries not to pay me back, or whatever, if Fred Nurk can spend the money, I can't. And then when it's repaid, I can spend the money, and Fred Nurk can't. So that's getting into what macroeconomic effect this has. But as an individual, if you lend money to somebody, then that means your spending power gets reduced. And of course, people will say, well, you know, unless you're doing it for somebody you want to be generous to, then you want some return for the inconvenience of not being able to use your own money.
And it's a liquidity thing as well, isn't it? Like you're going to charge more if you're going to tie up the money for longer, because you have to say, well, okay, if I need it in a year's time, that money isn't going to be available. So first of all, I've got to have enough cash to be able to lend it out. But also, I'm going to charge you more because you're tying it up for longer. Hence this, you know, which we see in bond yields, for example. The longer the term of the loan, the higher the interest is going to be, because you are tying it up for longer. But also there's more uncertainty about what's going to happen in that intervening time. If you've got money tied up for 10 years, who knows, you might have had an opportunity to use the money on something. Interest rates may have changed a great deal. Inflation might have changed as well. So you have to factor all of that in for the longer the period of the loan, which is the way government bonds work and yields work.
Yeah, but then we're transgressing from people who can't create money to people who can. So we've got to, you know, change the nature of our discussion. But fundamentally, the big thing is your uncertainty about the future. You know, you might lend somebody money and then expect your income to continue on as it was beforehand, so you can handle not having the cash buffer. And then suddenly something happens you weren't anticipating, and bang, you need that cash buffer, but you're doing without it. So if somebody is looking, if you do it informally, people can often forget that particular issue. I forgot that particular issue. but if you're doing it as a regular business, then you're going to be factoring that in. And then we're talking about money lenders and rates of interest from money lenders. And they will charge extremely high rates for a number of reasons. But if you're in the business of lending money, then you have to factor in the possibility of it not being repaid. And if you have a whole range of clients, then some of them them are not going to be able to repay. And then you have, you know, uncertainty about the future, you know, and those all get factored into how we think about interest rates.
Right. But I mean, all of that is good. But the question is, of course, I mean, as I say, it's the natural way of things, isn't it? Unless, of course, you know, you're giving a loan to, I don't know, you know, your own personal circumstance. I wouldn't charge interest to my kids, for example, but unless some people do because they think, well, it's a good lesson for the kids. So why not? But it becomes a problem, doesn't it, when people are making money out of having money. They're making money from interest without doing any real work, you know, passive income. And if you've got a lot of money and you can make a lot of money from passive income, then that starts to become a bad thing for society.
And that was the argument that the classical economists had towards rentiers. They said that, you know, if you give money to people, and they regarded rentiers as both people lending money without doing any work themselves, and then also landlords who, you know, give the land to a tenant farmer and then expect a share of the revenue simply because they owned the land. And the physiocrats were quite funny on this in a sense because they were brutally honest. The people who own the land are normally those who've taken it by force from people in the past and then give themselves titles of lords and ladies. But in fact, what they were initially were robbers. And you know, so there was a much more nuanced attitude towards getting a rate of return on money from the classical school of economics and its predecessors, the physiocrats, than we get today.
So, and does it count as GDP? If I give a loan to somebody, I mean, I know it sort of balances itself out, doesn't it? If I give a loan to you, you've got the money, I haven't anymore. But does it influence GDP, the measure of GDP? Because obviously, if I give a loan to you and you make good use of it and, you know, it was just going to sit in my bank account doing nothing, then it's got a more productive use. So surely it is helping with the GDP of the country.
Well, this is where it gets complicated, and this is where neoclassical economics goes off the rails. Because, you know, in the strict case, if I sold you a new microphone, then you pay me for the new microphone and there's a transfer of money and that turns up in GDP. But if I lend you money to go and buy a new microphone, then the lending is independent of GDP. The part that creates the GDP is you spending that. But for you to spend that money on the microphone, it means I might not be able to buy a new set of headphones. So your increase in GDP is offset by my fall in GDP. And overall, there's no necessary change unless you're more of a spendthrift than me,
right?
Which is unlikely.
Yeah. I don't know. out of necessity, perhaps. But I mean, just over those two scenarios, again, just very quickly, sorry, I understand. So if you gift me money, well, I mean, first of all, that's never going to happen. But if you do, then that's not counted as GDP in the same way. My mum gives me a bit of money for Christmas, for example. It's not counted as GDP. But if you give me the money,
it's different when a bank gives you the money. And this is where mainstream economics goes off the rails by using an analogy from private individuals giving each other loans to banks giving customers loans. If I lend you money, then my deposit account falls and your deposit account goes up by precisely as much. What we've done is reallocate where money exists in the economy. We haven't created any money. And then if you spend using that borrowed money, you will spend more on something than you could have done without my loan. But I necessarily have less money to spend. So the two balance out. And if you read, I don't recommend it, but if you read neoclassicals like Ben Bernanke, you'll find him saying that that is a loan is a pure redistribution, which absent implausibly high differences in marginal propensities to consume between groups should have no significant macroeconomic effects. That's a quote from the paper after the one he wrote that gave him the bloody Nobel Prize, and saying fundamentally rejecting Irving Fisher's explanation of the Great Depression, which saying it was a debt deflation. And Bernanke literally said that the debt deflation is no more than a transfer from one group debtors to another group creditors, which itself is stupid. But anyway, that basically said, well, you know, changing levels of debt between individuals, increasing the level of debt outstanding because of those sorts of loans shouldn't have any impact on the economy, and they're dead wrong. because when a bank creates a loan, it isn't a transfer of money from one bank account to another. It's an increase in the assets of the bank. The loan goes up, and it's an increase in the liabilities of the bank. The borrower's money goes up, but nobody borrows for the sheer benefit, the sheer pleasure of being in debt. You borrow to spend, and so that borrowed money is then spent buying goods and services off somebody else.
Right.
And that adds to aggregate demand.
So on that basis, I mean, it's obviously a good thing in that case if it's adding to that aggregate demand. So how do banks arrive at the interest rate that is going to allow that to happen? How's that determined?
Well, I mean, the starting point in a modern economy is the central bank sets a reference rate, which is then the rate that banks have to borrow each other if they borrow reserves from each other. You know, settlements funds a better way to describe it, but that's the rate that the central bank sets, and then that is used as a reference point by private banks. They will charge that rate plus a margin, which reflects their cost of doing business. Banks, you know, it definitely involve physical costs and wage costs and things like that to run a bank, plus the profit margin they want, and then plus their allowances for bad loans and so on. And a lot of this also reflects, of course, the rate of inflation. So there's a markup process that goes on between the rate that the central bank sets and the rate that the banks themselves charge. But it's often seen by conventional economists that this is a supply and demand issue. This is all effectively price setting, first of all, by the central bank to set what they think should be the base rate of interest, and then additional margins put on top of that by the private banking sector.
Right. And they set it based on what they want to do to the economy. I mean, that's what they argue, isn't it? If they set the rate too high.
The central bank.
The central bank does. So if they set the rate too high, then that might deter investment. So businesses aren't, able to invest in the machinery or whatever they need to sell more goods and services so the economy doesn't grow. But that's, that's when they say they want to cool things. So they set the interest rate high to try and stop the economy growing too quickly.
This is where we start getting in.
Does it work is the question.
No.
Yeah.
And this is where we start getting caught up in neoclassical nonsense for a whole range of reasons. But the most important reason is that the belief that mainstream economists have has been, you trace back where it comes from, and it comes back from the concepts that some of the classical economists had of a natural rate of interest. And certainly the neoclassicals and Austrians had this idea of a natural rate of interest, which is a bit like supply and demand in normal goods and services is a dollar price. And they thought supply and demand in terms of loanable funds is a rate of interest. And then if you have an increase in the rate of interest, more people want to lend, less people want to borrow. A fall, more people want to borrow, less people want to lend. There's an equilibrium rate, and that's that the market should set that rate. And that's the vision that they use. But it's flawed thinking when you apply it to a national economy and the rates set by the government. The biggest thing about it, and we can get back to that other point in a moment, is that that was seen by Hicks as being the control mechanism for the rate of investment. So the higher the rate of interest, the lower the rate of investment, because people could anticipate the future revenues they were going to get out of various investment projects, and then discount that by the rate of interest. So if you put the rate of interest up, you'd make more projects unprofitable, reduce the rate of investment, reduce the rate of interest, you'd increase the level of investment. And that saw the rate of interest as the main controller on the level of investment in an economy. And as Keynes argued, that's not the main control. The main control is how uncertain you are about the future. And if you are very uncertain about the future, it's not like you've got, there's been a financial crisis, you want to charge a high rate of interest because you're not sure you're going to get your money back. Your investment is going to be determined by your expectations of the future. And the rate of interest is relatively trivial in that. So it's investor confidence.
So you're throwing in the risk factor. But the interest rate, you're still working working with, you know, unknowns and trying to set a level of risk. So the interest rate would still be important there, wouldn't it? If you go, well, okay.
Not as important as your expectations.
Well, if you think the future is looking really bright, though, you might be prepared to accept a higher interest rate. If you think the future is looking a bit glum, then you might think, well, it's not worth borrowing unless the interest rate is exceedingly low and I'm getting a better return. Perhaps, you know, getting even down to zero, for example.
Yeah, but at the same time, what matters is how you think the economy is going to do and how you think the your investments are going to do. And this is where we get caught up in speculative investments, which is, you know, most borrowed money these days, unfortunately, is used to gamble on asset prices rather than used to build actual productive facilities. And if you were expecting like a 40% rise in the stock market, then you're going to accept any rate of interest up to close to 40% to get that borrowed money. So what you get is the expectations of future profit from asset speculation can be far higher than the rate of interest. And therefore, it's incredibly hard to stop a financial bubble using interest rates. Well, I'm talking to somebody who knows this bloke. You remember Christopher Skase?
Well, of course, yes, an Australian disgraced property developer.
He was a journalist, actually.
Originally.
And he switched over to property speculation and started building expensive residential complexes around the country. And charged enormous prices for, you know, supposedly exclusive residential complexes in various locations around the country. And in fact, what he was really doing was gambling on rising asset prices. He really had his cash flow was negative for most of his projects, and he was funded by Larry Adler. And I've forgotten Larry, FAI, I think the company was Larry Adler. Larry and Rodney Adler. You'd probably even met Rodney Adler. And the father and son act. And because Skase was so speculative in the projects he was putting on, normal banks wouldn't touch him. But Adler's company did. And father and son played a game where they'd alternate who would meet with Skase when he came in asking for the next loan. And he always needed a next loan because he was getting bridging finance before the asset sale because he wasn't getting enough cash flow with the assets. So without new loans, he couldn't repay the old ones. And the play game was that one would suggest an interest rate to him. And when he came in the next time round, you know, 3 or whatever months later, the other member, father or son would offer this rate plus 1%, just waiting to see at what rate Skate would finally say no. And he didn't say no, up to and including a rate of interest of 23%.
So, yeah, what could possibly go wrong there?
Well, the interest rate didn't really work as a control. Because the guy was expecting 40% appreciation on his assets and wanted to continue being able to pay the previous loan back and pay all his, you know, worker costs and so on, so he could make the point where the asset sale could occur and bang, he was free. And the classic thing about Skase was he decided to globalize and he put in a takeover offer for MGM. And there was a very canny investor on MGM's board who didn't believe this guy's financials. So he went through and did a very detailed examination of Skase's finances, found what I'm talking about, and then told MGM board not to accept the $3 billion takeover offer that Skase made for MGM. Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, for those who don't remember ancient movie producing companies.
Yes. Yeah.
And they turned him down. So he had a $3 billion offer. And 1 week after they turned him down, he went bankrupt because he couldn't meet a $16 million loan installment payment. Now, if he'd got the $3 billion offer accepted, he would have gone to Larry and Rodney, got the extra loan he needed to pay the purchase price, and paid that $16 billion outstanding loan installment out of spare change, and keep on going. So this is why you get such fragility in financial sectors.
But if money was only used for speculation. And we're pretty close to this anyway, aren't we, really? You know, and it's not used for productive use. It's just used to finance investments in the, you know, in the finance community. Then that idea of equilibrium, you know, that neoclassics economists love and central banks work on, that, you know, that the point of equilibrium, you know, is where the demand for borrowing and the supply of lending is matched. I mean, if everyone was just borrowing to speculate, then that would be true, wouldn't it? Because you wouldn't be dissuaded by the fact that some people might say, well, actually, we're going to pay a bit more because the returns are looking good, because the future, we think, is brighter than everybody else thinks. If everyone was just borrowing to speculate, then we'd be closer to that idea of equilibrium, wouldn't we?
No, we wouldn't. Further away, because uncertainty about the future is the other variable. And if you have everybody being confident, then what happens is that they're all willing to borrow. They're also equally willing to lend. So you get a low rate of interest coming out of those situations. And then when you have everybody fearful about the future, you get a high rate of interest because nobody wants to risk it. So you actually get the interest rate being perverse in that sense, enabling a boom to continue and then crushing the recovery when you would want to get to investment to occur again on the other side. So for this reason, Keynes was against the idea of using interest rates to try to control economic activity. And that's what neoclassicals turned it into through Hicks's misinterpretation of the general theory to make it into a Walrasian model where equilibrium applies. So yet again, this is another case where, to quote Keynes, equilibrium is blither.
Well, look, when we come back, I want to look more about how central banks arrive at their interest rate, but also why modern monetary theorists think that a neutral interest rate, and we'll talk about what the neutral interest rate is, but why they think that should actually be zero. So in other words, nobody, because wouldn't, you know, in that situation, wouldn't nobody lend anything at all, you know, because you'd get no reward for your lending. So how does that work? We'll look at that when we come back on the Debunking Economics podcast with me and Steve Keen. Back in a moment.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
So, Steve, there is an interplay, isn't there, obviously, between how much is charged in interest, what we're seeing in terms of growth in the economy and the opportunity that exists. But, I mean, who knows what that is? But more importantly, what the rate of inflation is. And obviously, that, you know, central banks are there trying to control inflation. But, I mean, the rate of inflation obviously also influences the interest rate and how much you are prepared to pay. So if I get a low interest rate and for a loan, and I know that inflation is going up, then I'm going to be very happy. But I'll also probably be prepared to pay a slightly higher interest rate if I know that inflation is going up. So there's this interplay, obviously, between, you know, what the inflation rate is and what the interest rate is.
Yeah, and that's, you know, that's like a sensible way of looking at it. I remember, like with my own family, my father vendor financed the sale of a country property, and the inflation rate with interest rate was 20% because it was 3% above the rate being charged on overdrafts at the same time, which is significant. About the high inflation people remember back in the 70s and early 80s. And so you will, as a lender, want to get a return above the rate of inflation. So that's like the private market, the private banking sector will have that that attitude. But whether they manage it or not is another story. So you'll often find, if you go back and take a look at the historical data, you'll see periods like the 70s and 80s, the rate of interest was below the rate of inflation, even with the attempts of central banks to modify the level. And what that means is, of course, and this is how Hyman Minsky explained stagflation. You had a booming economy leading to high wage demands and high increases in raw materials inputs, particularly energy. This is rises in 73 and 79, a huge increase in shares in workers' wage demands, a huge increase in raw materials prices. And the inflation rate was high, but then the economy tanked because of a private debt bubble burst, and you had low investment levels with high rate of inflation. And the high rate of inflation actually reduced the accumulated debt in real terms and enabled the economy to sputter on without actually completely collapsing. So there is an interplay between the two, but I'm afraid the way the central banks try to manage it is based on neoclassical theory, and like most things that they do, is off with the fairies.
It's not working for them. Well, you look at the situation, I mean, it's talking about stagflation. I mean, is that where the UK is right now? Because we've still got very high interest rates, and we've got an economy which has spluttered to zero, basically. I mean, I think year on year, GDP growth is something like 0.2%. In the last quarter, it's flatlined. That's stagflation, isn't it?
But now what you've got on the other side of the Atlantic is America with a relatively booming economy. And the main difference is not the interest rates. This is what comes down again to the way that Keynes has been distorted by neoclassicals. It's the level of government spending. The UK is running very tight austerity yet again, typical addiction of the UK to austerity. And the Americans are running a government deficit of about certainly more than 4% of GDP. And that deficit is stimulating demand, and also the high interest rates, which are being paid on new bonds that are being issued by the Federal Reserve, are giving yields of 5% to the banks that buy them off the Treasury, and that's growing the money supply as well in the finance sector. So your difference between the UK and the America doesn't come down to interest rates. It comes down to the level of government spending.
So the natural rate of interest is an interesting concept. I love the term natural, as though it is part of the natural world rather than something we've artificially created, that animal species obviously will also be concerned about what the natural rate of interest is. That David Attenborough should be doing documentaries of here the natural rate of interest amongst hyenas. But the Bank of England, says it's somewhere to, 2 to 3%. So does the Fed. So does the Bank of Canada. The ECB has it at 1.5%. But of course, it moves depending on stuff. So how are they arriving at this natural rate of interest, and what exactly does it mean in their mind and then in reality?
Look, in their minds, it means this equilibrium between supply and demand for loanable funds, which is the attitude that the mainstream economists have had to money right from the days of Valrhona and Co. in the 1870s. But there's also, and Wicksell had a similar concept too, a natural rate of money supply. That's what their foundations are back in that idea. What they talk about these days comes from Milton Friedman, and it's what they call the NARU, the non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment. And this was a invention of Friedman's in a paper called The Optimal Quantity of Money, where he assumed that money was dropped out of, wait for it, helicopters, and dropping money over the country, and that there was a natural rate that the economy would return to, which was pretty much equal to the rate of economic growth. And this belief that there is a rate of interest rate, which if you set it, you will get rate of unemployment, rather, if you set the rate of unemployment, that will give you a non-accelerating inflation rate of unemployment, where if you're at that rate of unemployment, the inflation rate doesn't change. And that's what they think they're trying to target. And when you look at it empirically, it just ends up being a lagged measure of the earlier rate of inflation or the earlier rate of unemployment. It's a chimera. It's something that doesn't exist, which economists get their knickers in a twist trying to work out its value.
Well, I mean, it's whether they strictly adhere to that or not. I mean, they obviously do keep an eye on the unemployment rate, but perhaps more than they should. But I mean, the rate they set really is this strange neutral rate. So I didn't want to explore that more about where that really comes from. I mean, if it's 2%, what does that figure mean? Where does that come from? But I mean, they set their policy rate based on the neutral rate plus what the expectations are for inflation, and then whatever they want to load on in terms of how they see that they need to impact the economy. So if they are tightening, they'll add more. If they're easing, they'll take some off. So, I mean, in theory, that sounds okay if you agree on what the neutral rate is. But how do you determine what the neutral rate is, or the natural rate? I mean, it's just a finger in the air, isn't it?
Yeah, it's chasing. It's a dog chasing a non-existent tail, and this is the. You know, if you look at what's happened in the rise in inflation after COVID and its fall since, banks have interpreted, rather the central banks thought that putting up the interest rates is what controlled the rate of inflation. But you then look at, you know, where the inflation wasn't coming from excess demand from workers, and this is often the background of what they think, that, you know, the high level of inflation is caused by high wage demands by workers and high consumption levels by workers. So let's put up the interest rate and reduce their desire to spend, and therefore we'll get a lower rate of inflation coming out of that. What you actually had was a supply chain disruption, increase in markups by firms, which is the argument that Isabella Weber makes quite cogently, that that's where the inflation has come from, not from workers' wage demands, but from increasing profit margins by corporations. And the rise and fall of those markups and the supply chain disruptions with COVID and then their removal, relatively speaking, afterwards, they were the main factors. And what the interest rate was and what workers' wage demands were pretty much tangential to the whole story. And your best example of this is Japan, which made no change whatsoever to its interest rate, but experienced much the same increase in inflation and then fall back again afterwards. So the interest rate is not a control and not a fine tuner for the economy in the way that neoclassical economists believe it is. And the main source of their fallacy is that they assume we can predict the future accurately. And therefore, the only thing you can do to change your expectations, change our behavior now, is to change the rate at which we discount that rationally, accurately expected future. And I want to throw in a quote from Keynes here, because this is Keynes from a paper called The General Theory of Employment, not the General Theory book, which is the theory of employment, interest rate, and money. And here's him having a go at people believing you can fine-tune things using interest rate. This is Keynes. Now, a practical theory of the future based on these three principles has certain marked characteristics, in particular being based on so flimsy a foundation, it is subject to sudden and violent changes. The practice of calmness and immobility, of certainty and security, suddenly breaks down. New fears and hopes will, without warning, take charge of human conduct. The forces of disillusion may suddenly impose a new conventional basis of valuation. All these pretty polite techniques made for a well-paneled boardroom in a nicely regulated market are likely to collapse. And that's the real world. That's the instability and the fragility of expectations. And the idea that you can fine-tune expectations by moving the interest rates by 0.25% at monthly meetings is just nonsense.
So it's the forward-thinking aspect of it, which is the concern. Because if you take it as a snapshot and say, well, the economy is looking pretty bad now, so we need to lower interest rates, that's sort of like a counter-cyclical approach. It's pretty much what Keynesian economics has been advocating.
Not on the interest rate. I mean, Keynes said the main controller is the level of government spending, the fiscal power. And that's what's being revived by modern monetary theory today, and saying that if you want to, you know, try to fine-tune the economy.
But if it went hand-in-hand, though, that would make sense, wouldn't it? If you sort of like said, well, okay, we're facing a downturn right now, so let's have more government spending and let's have more expansionary measures. Let's lower interest rates so that we increase borrowing and investment so we get out of this mess. Hand in hand, those two make sense, don't they?
Except they often go in opposite directions. But, yeah, fundamentally, this is one of the reasons that MMT argues for a constant interest rate, because it isn't the fine tuner. The main thing, if you're going to have the capacity to change levels of demand in the economy, is government spending. That's what we've got. There's an actual control principle that makes sense there, because government spending, excessive taxation, creates money, which is then spent and turned over and creates more GDP. So your actual control is fiscal policy, not interest rates.
But if you kept interest rates, and let's talk about MMT, I mean, because, you know, they seem to think we can get by with zero interest rates. But even if we said, well, we're going to have a set interest rate at 2%, if I think there's reasons developing that could be pushing up inflation next year for whatever, and, there, you know, there are signs, obviously, that, you know, we could, and you might be wrong on it, but if I believe that we are going to have higher inflation next year, then that's going to be that is going to be influencing what I am prepared to pay or accept when I'm either giving or taking a loan, won't it?
It will for individuals, but that doesn't mean that the banks themselves should be charged a different rate. And it doesn't mean fine-tuning. Interest rates come down to your expectations of future profit, and it's the expectations that are volatile. There's no way this comes back to the point. It's not a control mechanism. It only works when it crushes the economy, and that's what happened out with Vogler. We had high inflation back then, up to 20%, or actually no, about 17% in America. And Vogler was putting up the rate of interest in the belief that this would change people's expectations about the inflation, leading them to reduce their inflation, the rate of increase in prices, with very little shock to the economy. What it actually did, it caused the economy to tank. It had a recession. It broke the bargaining power of workers. It crushed the bargaining power of OPEC as well, and caused a fall in oil price and the reduction in wage demands because workers were massively unemployed. And that the recession, the Volcker known as the Volcker recession, that's what broke the back of inflation at the time, not this fine-tuning thing, which is the way neoclassicals think about it.
Right, but if we just had investment where you just paid 2% interest for whatever you did, isn't there a danger that you might suddenly get investment just steamrolls and completely outstrips demand, and then you get inflation coming out of it? I mean, how do you control that if you haven't got interest rates to try and vary the level of interest in taking out those loans?
Again, in that case, fiscal policy is more effective at controlling demand than the interest rate variations are.
But how does fiscal policy contain a hot economy other than taxing more?
That's the trouble. I mean, I would either see like bond sales to the private sector, attractive interest rates to get them to put their money into an income-earning asset, but therefore have less money to spend. And that was pretty much how bonds were used during the Second World War. And very effectively, they didn't finance the war. They took money out of circulation and meant that people weren't buying, silk stockings, then they were making more silk available for parachutes and making sure that price pressures weren't high. And one of the remarkable things about the Second World War is an incredible increase in investment, mainly directed at producing weapons and war machines as well. But that did not cause massive levels of inflation. And so if you want to look for successful inflation control, throw the neoclassical textbook away and go and take a look at what was done by people like John Kenneth Galbraith, who was one of the people in charge of price setting during the Second World War, to see why you had low inflation at a high period of extremely high aggregate demand.
Yeah, well, we talked about that last week, didn't we, very briefly, that the idea of right now, that would have been a good idea, wouldn't it, to issue bonds to try and curtail spending so people had less money right now, but they still had the money at some point in the future. The problem with that, of course, is that in the environment we are today, if the government was issuing bonds, everyone would see that just as an increase in government debt.
That's our trouble. We've got a totally distorted picture of what the government debt is about as well. And so, no wonder we stuffed the bloody economy up.
So,
not to mention the environment.
So some MMTers say, well, the interest rate should be zero. I'm just wondering, how does that work? Because there'll be absolutely no incentive to lend out money, would there?
I must admit, I haven't read this material in detail by MMT people. I know the paper. I'll have to take a look at it at some point. I differ in the sense of the rate you want banks to earn on bonds that they buy off the government, because I think that affects the behavior of banks. So there was in my father's day, he described banks as 3-6-3 businesses. Lend and borrow at 3, lend at 6, and be on the golf course by 3 o'clock. And what I take out of that is that when banks, when you had a reasonable rate of return on bonds, and they were like about 3% rate of return on bonds, banks were buying them. The purchase of bonds was financed by the deficit the government ran, and they got a 3% rate of return, which basically covered their costs and a bit more for running the transaction system that enables a capitalist economy to function. So my feeling is, I think If you banks don't get a decent return on bonds, they're more likely to get involved in trying to do predatory lending to the real economy, to the non-bank sector, and we get caught in asset bubbles. And I want banks. I want banks back on the golf course at 3 o'clock and not thinking they're masters of the bloody universe.
They're not causing damage.
Yeah.
Unless we did, and I mean, could we do something through policy to change how money is invested? So, I mean, could we use it, for example, to try and drive our green transition? So do we, for example, give interest-free loans or low-interest loans to a company if it meets various criteria, which might be, you know, more geared towards saving the planet, which is probably a good thing?
That's what you'll see was the practices of countries like Japan and Korea and Singapore. They had direction of where credit could be sent. And people must say that's a terrible intervention in the market economy. What it meant was banks weren't financing Ponzi schemes, which is what they've ended up doing otherwise, you know, financing share market speculation and financing speculation on property prices rather than providing working capital for real corporations. So to a large degree, the thing I would like to see is preventing banks for lending for asset speculation and therefore giving them only the option of supporting long-term consumption by workers and middle class, which is where car loans and housing loans come in, and working capital and investment capital by corporations, which would mean that, you know, money is being, the finance sector is serving the industrial sector rather than being a parasite on top of it. But a part of that to me would be a rate of interest on government bonds of about 3% to cover the cost of running the private transaction system.
So we started today by talking about, you know, on an individual basis, when you lend money to somebody, you expect a bit back perhaps in terms of interest, and that's based on how long they want to borrow the money for, but perhaps also, you know, what inflation is running at currently, and maybe also, you know, whether you're the only one available to lend the money or whether there's more people. And that's sort of like the marketplace which central banks assume that the whole economy is working in. You seem to be saying, well, that's not the way it works in reality. So therefore,
95% of loans are by banks to non-banks. The stuff I spoke about is minor.
Yeah, with money created, exactly. So so therefore, the idea of having a set interest rate at whatever that rate is agreed to be, so that there's some certainty, I guess. Then we get back to where we were talking about a week or two ago. What's the, other than the clearing function, what is the role of central banks? Then you start to say, well, maybe our friend in Argentina's got a point here.
Well, the clearing house, but also they're the venue through which bank bond sales by the Treasury are actually managed. They're not they don't originate.
Right, but it's a mechanical function.
Yeah,
it's not.
Yeah.
It's not a policy setting function. So the policy role of central banks disappears. It just becomes a mechanical institution that is, you know, just a, in effect, a bunch of clerics doing their work.
Yeah. They're not the lords of the lords or the masters of the universe. They should be, you know, put in their place and just play the role of enabling the interbank transactions to occur. And managing government bond sales, but I would rather see them buying the, you know, in a lot of ways buying the bonds outright, because they're basically the cashier for the government, and that's what they should have their role as. The trouble is, our mate in Argentina is also saying that there should be a balanced budget. So it's not what he's doing to the central banks that matters so much; it's what he's doing to the Treasury.
Yeah, exactly. All right, but so we won't follow his logic to the final degree then. Because really what we were saying, I think, is then that if all of that mechanical functionality sits with the central bank, then that's fine because they are politically neutral. All of the policy decisions should be made by the Treasury that is avoiding making difficult decisions because they're blaming it all on the Bank of England or the, you know, whatever your respective central bank is. So the fiscal controls, which are really driving things, should sit with the Treasury. Interest rates and monetary policy, we're sort of abandoning it in that case, aren't we? We're saying it doesn't exist anymore.
I think it's not effective. And like I think the functioning of the economy since neoclassical economists took over control in the 70s and emphasized the role of the central bank has been pretty bloody pathetic compared to what it was like beforehand. And the economic growth itself is an issue, which I keep on coming back to. But what they paraded themselves on was they're going to have a more stable economy and will grow more rapidly, and we won't need all these welfare components, so we can cut the government spending. In fact, the rate of economic growth after neoclassicals took over in the 70s, 75 roughly, has been about half what it was when the Keynesians were in charge in the Second World War in 1975. So, you know, it's a false promise. It's been a waste of time. We should abandon it and go back to where fiscal policy is the control and the central bank is basically a functionary, not a master control system.
Wow. Doing away with monetary policy entirely is basically what you're saying, isn't it? Interesting stuff. All right, very good. We'll leave it there for now. Have a great Christmas, Steve. We'll catch you again very soon. Thank you.
Okay, bye.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
If you've enjoyed listening to Debunking Economics, even if you haven't, you might also enjoy The Y Curve. Each week, Roger Hearing and I talk to a guest about a topic that is very much in the news that week. It's lively, it's fun, it's informative. What more could you want? So search The Y Curve in your favorite podcast app or go to ycurve.com to listen.